You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Welcome to the Second City. I'm Kelly Leonard, and you are at a live podcast taping for the Getting the Yes And podcast, which is a production of Second City and WGN Radio. So my guest is Ann Libra. She is the director of comedy studies for the Second City and Columbia College Chicago, where she created the Comedy Writing and Performance BA. How many of you are her students? Yeah! She served as executive artistic director of the Second City Training Centers and Education Programs from 2001 until 2009. She has worked with the Second City since 1986 and has taught in its training center since 1991. Where her students have included Ashley Nicole Black, Amy Poehler, Kristen Schaal, Jordan Peele, and Stephen Young. Total hacks. Anne is presented on topics in improvisation comedy at the Aspen Ideas Festival, Code Conference, Chicago Ideas Week, TCG's annual conference, and guest lectured at the Stanford Business School. Her book, The Second City Almanac of Improvisation, is published by Northwestern University Press. But tonight, we're talking about her brand new book, also published by Northwestern. It's called Funnier, A New Theory for the Practice of Comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, Ann Libra. Quote, I'd like to start by getting one thing out of the way. I am not funny.
It's true.
Elaborate.
I'm not a naturally funny person. And I remember sitting with a bunch of my friends from Northwestern University at a reunion. And they were talking, I was talking about the comedy degree and the things that I do in comedy. And I looked up and said, let's face it, I was not funny in college. And they all went, oh yeah.
But you know funny.
But I understand funny. I am fascinated by what makes something funny. Yeah. Right? And that's, and what I love, I get to work with really funny people. And I get to help them make their thing funnier. So I think it's for me, it is really about using my comedy brain to make something happen as opposed to using it to be funny.
All right. I also love this line in the introduction that is a response to the well-worn idea that analyzing comedy ruins it. And you write, quote, every artist and artisan takes apart the thing they love to understand the inner workings.
Yeah, well, so this is the thing, is that, you know, so many people say you shouldn't analyze comedy, and it's true, right? That when you don't, when you analyze comedy, it makes it less funny. But the point isn't to enjoy that particular joke or that particular moment over and over again, and my touring company members who may be here, you know, that when we take something apart, it gets way less funny to us. But that it's really about how do you can't make it better until you understand what's working or not working about it and what the pieces are.
Yeah, and I mean, as you point out, that is something that everyone who becomes an expert in a performance field certainly,
that is
what they do. But I think that's also part of the snobbery around comedy.
Yeah, people think that comedy is somehow not that hard, and you either have it or you don't, and that's, you know, the other story that I tell in the book is I literally had to say when I was pitching the degree in comedy writing and performance at Columbia College Chicago, and literally the people at the committee were like, well, can you teach comedy? Like, yes. it's not, you know, the people want to think of it as something magic. Mm-hmm. And because it feels like magic. It feels like magic when we laugh. It feels like magic when somebody makes something, somebody we don't know, and it connects to our brain in that unbelievable common way, right? But what we know, and we know here, is that comedy's hard work and requires a lot of specific knowledge and trial and error. And there's lots of ways that you can make your comedy better.
I'm just thinking about this right now, which is like, we know like so many people who got into this particular work, sort of Second City and the improv field, because they were too lazy to memorize scripts.
100% true.
And I think one of the things is like, you're happy to write it down. You're happy to read it, you're happy to write it down, you're happy to memorize it. And so you're that rare bird that showed up at this place where everyone else is like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, there was that rare bird who was like, what if we worked hard on this?
Yeah. Not that people don't work hard here.
No.
All right, let's go through some definitions, because I think these are important.
Yeah.
So first, what's your definition of comedy?
My definition of comedy is something that is created to elicit laughter or humor in a given audience. So if humor is a feeling we have, and laughter is a sound we make, when we create comedy, we are utilizing the elements of comedy that we'll talk about in a second in order to generate laughter or humor in a given audience. And I think that's really important, because I'm going to make different comedy if I'm going to try to make my dad laugh. And certainly, we know here at the Second City that we're going to make different comedy for different audiences depending on what's happening in the world, who's in that audience. You know, we've had some very different shows in, say, Pennsylvania than we have had here in Chicago.
This is important. This is an important
note. Not to bring up bad news.
No. Yeah. No, where I'm going with this is the fact that, like, this isn't about, like, why we laugh.
Yes.
This isn't it is very specific about the creation of professional comedy.
Yes.
And I think what we've experienced in our life reading these books that maybe live in this world, it's either an academic who's just really interested in comedy but doesn't know anything about it, or it's a person who's worked in comedy who
just want to tell you what they did.
Yeah.
Right? But they're also thinking very specifically. So it's somebody who's worked in sitcom who's telling you how to write sitcom, somebody who's worked in late night telling you how to write a certain kind of joke, somebody who's worked in stand-up telling you how to write a different, completely different kind of joke. And the thing that I think was really obvious to me from the work that I've done here and then ultimately from working and teaching students is that there's a sort of unity to comedy, and that we have a tendency to think of it as medium specific, but in fact, the people who are the most successful comedians are writer, director, performers who are able to take their ideas and translate them across mediums. And so for me, that was the thing that I really got excited about digging into, was what, if there are unities, what are they, and how can I help my students to see them?
So let's go through the five components.
Okay, so thinking about comedy as existing in really five different ways, and the first one is jokes, and naturally, you know, jokes are synonymous with comedy, and maybe even, you don't really have jokes outside of comedy, right? And a joke is a setup and a punchline. That's what a joke is. That is the... someone was like, talking to me, like, what is the definition of a joke? And it's a setup and a punchline. That's what it is. physical comedy, which for me is not just slapstick. I think we tend to think of physical comedy as slapstick, but it is really comedy of the senses. So it is our awareness of what bodies do. It is sound comedy, so why are certain sounds funnier to us than other sounds? It is comedy of, I'm completely forgetting what the different senses are, but visual, it is visual comedy, right? It is all those different ways that we process comedy. Is a part of physical comedy and other things like other senses, because of course we have more than five. the comedy of awareness of our bodies in space, or whether a body is moving itself. So if you ever see an old-timey comedian who's playing drunk do the thing where he has to move his own legs, right? All of that is physical comedy. So jokes, physical comedy, narrative, which is, for the most part, not a huge part of comedy. I think there are specifically comedy narratives that are orders. So here at Second City, we do running orders. The order that you do something in actually creates the way the comedy works. Interestingly, a lot of comedy films tend to borrow other narratives. They do parodies. So there's the really variety, I think, is the primary comic narrative. Character, which, so jokes don't travel well. It's really hard to tell a joke and translate it into another language and have it still work, because there's so many specific things. But character seems to be eternal. It seems that we have known the same crazy characters since ancient Greece, if not earlier. There are trickster characters who are sort of a classic comic character across the globe in almost every society known to man. So character becomes this sort of essential place where we are connecting with a very true humanness. And then the final thing is point of view. And point of view was not really important in comedy, certainly not here in the United States, up until about the 1950s, 1960s. You suddenly get people like Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce and The Second City, where you are laughing not just at the joke, but at the way the people who are telling the joke look at the world. And for modern comedy, most of our favorite comedy comes from that idea of connection to somebody else's brain. It's like, oh, I see you. Oh, you think like me. And that's where that comedy is. You know, and it's funny because what we now call dad jokes, right, are point of view-less jokes, jokes that anybody can tell. But then we gave it a persona.
It's funny, as you were talking about character, mm-hmm. we had a deal for a few years with a group called Yoshimoto out of Japan. And we went there, but then artists from their very particular duo comedy came here and learned improv. But what, and they did the improv set, and they didn't speak English. So what worked, and it was all character stuff.
Yes, and it was the character, and I think the other thing that I think of actually as an element of physical comedy is the play. They were such amazing players. They played with each other in a way that we felt that we connected to.
All right. There's a bunch of great stories in the book from specific stuff you've done, either in the training center or the touring.
Yes, I use a lot of examples from people.
So there's three I'm going to ask you for, and the first one is the one we talked about backstage, because Brendan Jennings, I don't know if folks know him, fantastic Second City alum, emailed Ann today because his son
Hayden wants to take comedy college.
Yeah. So, that was just a huge thing for her. But then that sparked a memory for you about.
Right. Well, Brendan. So I actually used the example in the book when I did Brendan's grad show on this stage, and he created what for me was just a kind of ideal premise for a sketch. Where you take something in something that everybody knows, but then find something that's really unusual about it, or something that's wrong about it that you've never paid attention to. And so his premise was, it's the end of The Wizard of Oz, and Dorothy is saying goodbye to everybody, and she says, and Brendan's playing the Tin Woodman, and she says goodbye to him, and she goes to the Scarecrow and says, I think I'll miss you most of all. And there's this long pause, and Brendan goes, Pam? You're going to miss him most of all. And then proceeds to just like unleash this torrent of, and I did this for you, and I did that for you. And you're like, of course. And then he actually became the Wicked Wizard of the West. It's just such a lovely recognition of a moment in something that we all knew but didn't see in another way.
Alright, the other one, and this is always my favorite story, is Jordan Klepper. was in class, and he had a very memorable Saint sketch.
Okay, so there's actually a group. I had done his grad show, and then we did a group afterwards to do an independent show, and he came in with what was both the most terrible premise and one of the funniest premises I've ever seen, which is he was a guy who was running for office. Vice president, running for vice president of the United States. He was a doctor who cured cancer. And then the people are in the house asking him questions, news questions, and somehow out of nowhere he says, you know, except for Anne Frank, who I hate. and they're like trying to make it okay for him. And they're just saying that, no, have you read the book? Wine. example, it's a really dark premise, right? And part of what we had to do with it was to make it okay for an audience. We had to find ways to this, and Jordan already, which is what he does on Daily Show, is he's got this sort of lovely warm presence, so he can get away with being really evil because there's something about him. But we also had to find a way to make it not in any way anti-Semitic, right? We had to not pull up memories of Holocaust stuff. We really had to make it about how teenagers are really annoying. And also about how politicians are not allowed to make mistakes, although they are now.
All right, last one of this round, John Reynolds.
Okay, again, it's a grad show, and he pitched week after week after week some of the most disgusting, dark, this was during the Joe Paterno scandal.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I'm going to say. Shantira Jackson was awesome in that class, and contact and go. But I could see, I mean, he was interested in comedy that was transgressive. He was interested in the idea of doing something that everyone would have a reaction to. And I could see what was funny to him about it. Like, I got where he was coming from. We just couldn't put any of those sketches on stage. And so what I ended up doing was I had him sit down and write a little monologue for himself, where he got out on stage and complained about the fact that I did not allow him to put in any of his really, really funny ideas. And then he read, in a list, pitches that he really did in class. That's all he did. They were all real, real pitches. And the audience was like, oh. But it was really funny because, again, and this goes back to the theory, my comedy theory. So basically, comedy, from my perspective, we are manipulating three primary elements. And we may do them in a physical way, we may do them in a joke way, but fundamentally we're manipulating recognition. So you can get a laugh, and anybody here who's a comedian knows you can get a laugh just on recognition, right? If you say something that the audience knows, they will respond. But also deeper recognition, our understanding of the way our brains work, characters recognition, right? So recognition, pain. You don't have comedy without pain, okay? And it might be slapstick pain, it might be the pain of fear or childhood fears that are no longer true anymore. It can be pain of, one of the funniest things, one of the things that has been funny throughout history is people who are in power falling down, right? And actually, in a lot of history, it's been people who are not in power falling down. That's the king's fool.
Talk a little bit.
I know, I'm like going off on more things.
It's okay.
So the idea of the King's Fool, which I think is a really interesting, you know, it's an interesting idea. Sometimes as comedians, we want to make ourselves noble. But I do think there's something of value here, which is that during the era of the divine right of kings, a lot of courts would have what was originally a natural fool, which meaning somebody who had some kind of mental disorder or psychiatric disorder that they would make fun of or laugh at. Eventually it becomes a job. And the king's fool was an entertainer who wore, you know, the bells, this is the jester, or the bells, that you didn't see that fool as being a serious person. But what the value of the king's fool was is that the king's fool was, that if a king who did not have a fool was seen as a lesser king, because the king's fool was the one place where the king might have someone who spoke truth to power. And, you know, it's very noble and exciting. It's also, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the fool would speak truth to power and then get beaten up, and they would find that funny too. But this idea of pain as being an essential part of comedy is, I think, you know, and again, pain of mistakes, pain of error, but also pain, you know, you have people on the way, you know, gallows humor, people who joke about really terrible things. So, you know, surgeons in an operating room. But the third element is part of that, which is that it's because it's just for the pain, it's not funny. You have to have something that provides psychological distance. You have to have a way for the people who are experiencing this truly pain to see it from a different place. And that can be physical distance, you know, it can be temporal distance, tragic plus time equals comedy. It can be physical distance, a great Mel Brooks quote, tragedy is when I cut my finger, comedy is when you fall in an open sewer and die. but distance is the way, and one of the things I think that's interesting about this is that we're sort of titrating, right, from depending on the audience. So going back to that John Reynolds thing, there are things that he could have done with those premises and with those jokes, and he could have done them for a certain audience that has so much psychological distance on pain that it's really funny to them, right? I knew that for a general audience, they did not have that distance. But I had to create artificial distance through having him tell you the thing rather than actually seeing the moment.
I mean, this is the thing with the Annoyance Theater, that they called themselves the Annoyance, so right. You knew going in if you were annoyed what they had done their job. So they said that. It's interesting, because I want to talk more about recognition. I don't know if you noticed that you slipped in calling truth.
I know, well, so this is the interesting thing. I used, when I first started working on this, I thought it was truth. And I think there's an aspect of truth, but you know, we can get into comedy ethics. But when we laugh at something we recognize, we sometimes feel that it is true, but it doesn't have to be true. And lots of times when we laugh with a group of people, and it'll make us think that something we recognize is actually something true. Right?
And the one thing that really doesn't exist in any of the major comedy theories, and there's a whole comedy theory section,
right.
Which for certain people will be like the whaling chapters in Moby Dick.
It's for the nerds.
It's for the nerds.
But also, actually, it's for the nerds, but there's a lot of, you know, this is my sort of overarching theory, and I want to say this is a new theory of comedy. It's not a theory of all the reasons why people laugh. It's really a theory that's about what do we use when we're creating comedy. And a lot of the other humors and a lot of the other theories are historic, and they're really trying to do all instances of humor, including like why we're laughing or tickled.
And none of them include recognition.
Yeah, they. And yet it is the one element of the three that you can get a laugh at just on recognition.
And one of the examples we always use of that in Second City terms, especially when we started to create more narrative sketch shows, mm-hmm. is if you simply had a character who you knew from the first act do a walk-by behind the audience, the second act gets a laugh.
Right.
It's like nothing happened except for that actor walking by.
But I know that! Yeah, well, it's you know, in corporate we have what we call the Bob from Accounting effect, which is, you know, if you're interviewing a corporate audience to do a corporate show, if you drop the name of some really recognizable guy that everybody knows, and say Bob from accounting, they're like, yeah, it's so funny.
Literally happening upstairs right now in the comedy club. I saw Evan Mills on the escalator.
I'm saying Bob from accounting.
Can you, so while we're in this world of definition, the difference between parody and satire?
Oh, okay. Parody is making fun of a style. So when we parody, we're making fun of the form of a thing. So we can do a police procedural parody, right? Satire, so parody's about form. Satire is about point of view. Satire is about, and you may use parody. This is why it gets complicated, because lots of, the Colbert Report is a really good example, right? It was a parody of a kind of talk news show that had satiric elements, but satire is about pointing out something in the world that you believe needs to be changed. So satire is, may exaggerate elements of behavior. No, I mean, there's the one essay that everybody has to read about children, Irish children being made into pies. Jonathan Swift, I believe. But satire is about taking a point of view and exaggerating it to the point that you realize that something needs to be changed.
All right, let's talk a little bit about some of the behavioral science stuff. So.
Okay.
To get
as we like ourselves in the
universe. Yeah, well, the delight. Our friend Linay Gandhi was the sort of chief of staff for a guy named Danny Kahneman, who would win the Nobel Prize in economics, even though he never took an economics class in his life. She got him to sign his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, to Anne, and it's like the most prized possession. But that book really had an impact on you, and actually on me too, because it is innately connected to our work.
Well, okay, so I got really obsessed with this book, and I remember talking about it to anybody who would listen here at Second City,
which was like three people.
but what Kahneman talks about is this idea that we have two parts of our brains. We have the fast brain, and the fast brain. Jumps to conclusions. It works. So if I say to you 2 + 2, you're immediately thinking
4.
Right. Well, if you've done math classes in an American school. Then we also have a part of our brain that has to figure things out. And a lot. So if I ask you to add, 2 4-digit numbers, there's probably a couple of you could, but for the most part, you have to like get out a piece of paper and write it down. And comedy plays with the way that our brain, that fast brain, jumps to conclusion. Right? That's a joke. The joke is, I'm going to set you up for your fast brain to jump to a conclusion. And then I'm going to give you another equally valid answer that your slow brain has to figure out how it works. And there's a whole series of sort of biases and heuristics that Kahneman identified that are all the elements that we use to make comedy. And there's some good thought that maybe part of the reason that we developed laughter and comedy was as a way of checking that part of our brain that jumps to conclusions and making it so we laugh because it's pleasurable to be tricked, because it's good for our bodies to know, it's good for our brains to know that we jumped to a conclusion and to an error, and that error got checked.
I'd write a thing for a client, and I have my notes from rereading the book, and you have a really delicious quote in here that I use at credit. I don't always, which is...
I know. We spent too much time together, and he's like, oh, yeah, this is my idea.
The gap between what we assume we know and what we actually know is the space where surprise lives. It's pretty cool.
That's wow.
All right, so my
my proudest contribution to this book is when you use the example of how during COVID, our son Nick and I toured Chicago looking for the best Italian beef sandwiches. How does that end up in a book about comedy?
Okay, so again, comedy is recognition. The most useful thing you can do as a comedian is to get to know the world. I have my students write lists of things they know, but I also want them to get out into the world and try something. And so one of the things I really push people to do is to get to know, become an expert on a topic. Start to learn about something that maybe some people know and some other people don't know, because that's where that recognition and surprise can come into the work, because people love to find out new things, and they also love it when you say things that they already know. And your ability as a comedian to find those things and dig into those things. And, truthfully, being an expert on Italian beef is a perfect comedy thing.
Yeah.
Right? Particularly pre-bear, which is what you...
No, it's pre-bear.
They're very excited.
And the things we would come back and talk about. So, like, the very first one we went to was Roma, which is good. Not top 10, but good. And it's on Cicero, just off of Lawrence, I believe.
Yeah.
And across the street, Nick and I look up and we're like, well, that was clearly a Taco Bell that is now a law office for Peter Francis Tracy. it's ridiculous. And also, the best beef places, and this is during COVID, no one's wearing masks. There's no COVID where the good beef is.
But it's that all the things you're just talking about, this recognizable experience, but also surprise and unusual. And so one of the biggest things that comedians have to do is to seek out the world outside of where your audience is going to be, and then bring it back to that. And that's where that really cool recognition comes.
All right, you mentioned comedy ethics. You also talk about good comedy hygiene.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about those two things, because I don't know that people understand what that is.
Well, no, because I sort of like try to name the things that I knew I needed to talk about, particularly with my students. So good comedy hygiene is, for me, just really good ways of behaving as a comedian in the world, right? Which means that if you created something with a bunch of other people, even if it was primarily your idea, that before you use it in another place, you go back and ask that first group of people. Right? That's just good comedy hygiene. And even if it's really your idea, I guarantee you that if you put it up, somebody from that group, without asking, somebody from that group will be sitting in the front row crying. So it's just about like how to be a better collaborator, but also things like paying attention to when how you're taking care of your audience. It's wide open. This actually, though, this, we're moving into comedy ethics,
yeah,
which is how am I taking care of what might be dangerous for my audience? How am I taking care of what might be painful for my audience? So on a really simple level, I think it's not fair to use a really loaded thing for like cancer for people as the punchline of a joke before you move on to something else, right? I'm not saying you can't use, and there's the brilliant Tignataro Largo set where she had just been diagnosed and comes out on stage and says, hello, I have cancer. But then takes care of that audience, and she can say, it's okay. So it's really funny, but it's also really sad and scary. And I think comedy can be that. But the comedy ethics part is you don't just say that and run away. Right? It's like throwing a ball of fire in the audience's lap and then running out the door, right? And so, but it's also, comedy ethics is about being aware that your audience has different levels of distance than you do. It's about being aware that it's really interesting what is offensive to different groups of people. And because oftentimes there's a tendency to think that offense happens at the speaker's mouth, But so often it happens at the listener's ear.
Yeah.
Right? The listener sees something or hears something that they feel is sacred to them and that the comedian should know better. And so part of the comedy ethics is really, here's the real answer. There is no good answer to whether a joke should be told. There's only a series of questions that you have to ask yourself about where you're telling that joke, to whom, what has just happened, what are all the variables, and also, this is a weird thing, but there are comedians who can get away. Brian Gallivan had a really disgusting
Make-A-Wish.
He was a Make-A-Wish kid who wanted to have group sex with George Clooney and his friends.
That's where he wanted his Make-A-Wish
kid. Yes. And it was a monologue, and here's the thing, when Brian did it... Brian Gallivan did it, it was funny, because there's something, like Jordan Klepper, there's something about Brian Gallivan that you trust. When Brett Morris was understudying him, but this is also part of that. It's how do we find ways to, you know, it's not that anything is off limits. There's just ways that things affect certain audiences in certain ways. And as a comedian, I think it is incumbent upon you. On a fundamental level, to be thinking about that. You may choose to do something that is way out there, and that's okay. You have to think about who your audience is. To go back to that Anne Frank piece, part of the deal was we were doing it as a late night show for a group, for a bunch of 20-somethings, and it was the 90s. That sounds like a joke, but it's true. Things felt a lot safer in the 90s. I think we have to be aware of the fact that cultural elements that have nothing to do with us. I mean, it's as simple as jokes that worked pre 9/11 stopped working immediately.
Yeah.
Post 9/11.
Yeah, and you talk about in Pinata Full of Bees, there's this great scene called Gump.
Right.
With Adam McKay and Scott Adsit. And we can't tour it anymore.
Right, because it uses the R slur, which at the time that sketch was written was both a playground slur and a clinical diagnosis. So the sketch played with the lines between them. Ironically, actually, that clinical diagnosis has sort of set off a series of slurs. Like, pretty much every clinical diagnosis for those kinds of issues become, like, moron was originally a clinical diagnosis. But being aware of, like, where society is and where your audience is. The other story I always tell is Adam McKay and Brian Stappen, they were in my touring company, had a sketch called Baby Heads. And literally the sketch was Adam was a vendor, like at a
baseball game.
But instead of hot dogs, he was selling baby heads on a waffle cone or a pita. They were $2,000. Because they're baby heads. It's like a bear claw, right? Nope, actual baby heads. But, you know, we literally, that touring company did a show for the Neonatal Nurses Association. We did not do baby heads for them.
We talked about it.
And to be fair, they might have gotten the irony and might have been, but you were part of that comedy, comedy ethics is thinking about where the people are that you're doing comedy for and the time in which you're doing it.
All right, we're going to wrap up in a second, so Anne, go out and sign your books. When I finished the book, I don't think I had read your last chapter, because I don't think it had finished by the time. And one of the things you say in that chapter is, quote, "Don't waste your time following gurus,"
yeah,
which I love. So talk about that.
Oh, that's good comedy hygiene.
Yeah.
That is to say that if you are funny, if you are someone who knows how, who's learning how to do this work. Your teachers can help you, but you are the person who is funny, and sometimes the again, this is sort of like the comedy hygiene stuff. People who are in power will give people special advances. They'll give them jobs maybe they're even not ready for, and then sort of exact payment back. What's important to me is that people know that if they get that job, it's because they're ready for it, and they can be grateful to a teacher, but that they earned it. And that your job as a comedian, as a student, as a person who wants to make art, is to take what you can from the people who can teach you, but then go forth and make your own thing because it's yours.
So last thing,
yeah.
You got the deal for making this book, what, 8 years ago?
Yes, roughly. So are you going to go there? I've been teaching these ideas. I've been throwing these ideas around. I was desperately trying to get tenure at college. I pitched this book to Northwestern University Press and got the contract. And then...
Then our
daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer. So I wrote a good, healthy chunk of the first draft of the book in the hospital, at Lurie Children's Hospital with Nora there. I'm going to tell a good Nora thing.
Yeah.
One of the other things in the book I talk about is we talk about physical comedy and comedy of sounds, and Nora had a set of words that she found extremely funny. And they were bosom, cuticle, tufted headboard.
I know, Nick just texted, our son texted us this the other day, goes, you remember that Nora found those words funny?
And Nick would just say them and she would just start laughing. Frequent. Frequent was her other funny word.
Yeah.
Frequent, bosom, cubicle, and tufted headboard.
I bring it up also because it, like, the journey of the book was an amazing one, and you did it.
I know. It's been 7 years. I wrote a lot of these. Examples in the book from my attic because I wrote a bunch during COVID.
Yeah. The book is called Funnier, A New Theory for the Practice of Comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, Ann Liberick.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.